I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Ukraine crisis, NATO crisis, conflict between Moscow and Washington. It grows. And Professor Stephen Cohen, Stephen F. Cohen of New York University and Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, is here to comment on an extraordinary development in these last hours. Not for 2 years had the Secretary of State, John Kerry, met with significant principal opposites in Russia. Not for 2 years. He's spoken to Mr. Lavrov often over this last year of Ukraine crisis. But within these last hours, John Kerry flew to Sochi, which is where it all began, you might recall, during the Sochi Olympics and the breakdown of conversation between Washington and Moscow. Mr. Kerry flew to Sochi to sit with the president of Russia and the foreign secretary of Russia, Mr. Lavrov, sit at a table, grinning with their translators right and left. I believe Wendy Sherman is the principal negotiator, deputy secretary of state, on her way to negotiate over the Iran deal in Europe, was with Secretary Kerry. And the smiles on the faces of the Russians tell a story that something has changed. Steve, a very good evening to you. I mentioned this meeting in Sochi comes within hours of the Secretary General of NATO, Mr. Stoltenberg, making remarks that it is NATO's opinion right now that Russia is preparing for war in eastern Ukraine, that Russia has been arming and increasing the arms flow to the rebels, the separatists in eastern Ukraine, and that war could break out at any moment. Hours later, Mr. Kerry flies to Sochi. How to explain this development? What aren't we seeing? Good evening to you, Steve.
I can do no better than what you and I have done together for months, that we see and we hear daily, weekly, two Western voices regarding the Ukrainian crisis. One seems to want a military showdown with Russia, and it has, I don't want to use the word propaganda, it has an information agency that comes out of Brussels, out of NATO and Washington, that says that the Russians are violating ceasefires and preparing for a major assault in eastern Ukraine. There is, so far as I can tell, no objective information for a basis for that. But that comes out almost every day. Then you have on the other side the group of countries led by Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, that brokered the Minsk Agreement in February, which called for a ceasefire, which is more or less in place in eastern Ukraine, to be followed by political negotiations between the rebel leaders and the leaders of Kiev. Now, notice that the premise behind these two perspectives, the one that sees this war is the only solution, and the other, to quote Merkel, there is no military solution, sees negotiations as the only solution. There are conflicting premises here. The war faction sees the underlying cause of the Russian Ukrainian crisis as, quote, Russian aggression. The Minsk people, sometimes called the Normandy format because it involves France, Germany, and Russia, see the underlying cause in Ukraine as a Ukrainian civil war requiring negotiation. And so, as you now report, we see the representatives of both in the last 2 or 3 days speaking publicly. The head of NATO speaks of Russian aggression. The military commander of NATO, an American, speaks of Russian military aggression. Members of the United States Senate of both political parties clamor that we for weapons to be sent to Ukraine. Meanwhile, Merkel travels, was it yesterday, May 10th, to Moscow to meet with Putin in connection with the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, and says once again there is no military solution. And then today we knew Lavrov was going to Sochi. Kerry, Secretary of State Kerry, was going to Sochi to meet Lavrov. It was not guaranteed that Putin would meet with him, but he did. And now, if you want, we can try to figure out what that means. But Kerry clearly aligned himself today, whether he personally likes it or not, with there is no military solution position, that there got to be negotiations. And otherwise, Putin would not have met with him, I think.
I want to lay out some significant names here and see if I have the order of battle correctly. We have Secretary Kerry traveling to Sochi to meet not only with Lavrov and Putin. However, you mentioned Angela Merkel, and her visit to Moscow comes before the Kerry trip. We can guess, Steve, that in some fashion, something happened in Moscow between Merkel and Putin that moved Mr. Kerry to suddenly go to Sochi and meet with Mr. Putin. Perhaps Mr. Kerry understands that Merkel is no longer on the side of the United States on this?
I think I disagree with you here. I think that the Kerry trip to Sochi to meet Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia,
right,
was a given. It was scheduled before yesterday. What was not certain was that Putin would step down in rank. In other words, he should meet with President Obama.
Right.
Step down in rank.
I see.
And meet with Kerry. I agree with you, though, that something was agreed between Putin and Merkel yesterday, when Merkel on Monday, that led Putin to make what is a fairly momentous decision to find time to sit down with, which, of course, elevates Kerry as a player in this whole thing because he's been marginalized, partly because Europe has paid no attention to him and partly because he hasn't said anything useful. What might have brought this about? What I'm going to say is more than speculation, but less than certainty. If the analysis that you and I have discussed for weeks is correct, that you have in the West not one voice but two factions, one leaning toward war with Russia, the other seeking to avoid it. The Germans playing the leading role of accommodation or peacemaking, with this Minsk Accord being the manifestation of that, and hanging in the balance. Merkel and Putin must have decided that this was the last chance to actually implement the Minsk Agreement and compel Kiev, which has refused to do so, to live up to the political part of Minsk, which is to negotiate with the rebels in the east. Putin evidently told Merkel, because he said something on May 9th and 10th that suggested this, that he would do everything in his power to be sure that the rebels in the east, who depend on him, would actually negotiate in a sensible way if Kiev comes to the table, which it hasn't done. And I think because Kiev is essentially, forgive me everyone, a client regime of Washington, that Putin agreed to meet with Kerry, seeking that commitment from Kerry that the United States would now lean on Kiev to get Kiev to the negotiating table. I think that's what happened in Sochi today and why Putin made the time for Kerry. Now, it's ultimately a guess, but it's based on a study of everything that's been happening in recent weeks and most recently in the last 2 days.
I'm speaking to Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History. John Kerry to Sochi to sit with President Putin and Foreign Secretary Lavrov. A detail from the statement that Mr. Kerry made at the close of these conversations, because Mr. Kerry then flew on to Turkey to meet with NATO representatives in Turkey, including, of course, Ukraine representative at the NATO meeting. Mr. Kerry indicated that Minsk II needs to be implemented. He did not mention Crimea. What does that mean? When we come back, I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. We are examining what the significance of the meeting between Secretary of State John Kerry and President Putin in Sochi. Sochi is where the Olympics were held. Sochi is where President Putin spends his holiday. It's on the Black Sea. This is the Black Sea Basin, where Ukraine, where Crimea is. And leaving this meeting, the quotation points to Minsk II, the secretary eager to get on to implementing Minsk II, and we can then begin the rollback of sanctions, says the Secretary of State. He does not mention Crimea. Is that an accident, Steve? Is that a reporter not scribbling it all down, or is that significant?
Merkel, to make everything more complex, And again, I see Merkel as the peacemaker.
This is the Chancellor of Germany. Yes.
For some time, and we have the evidence, it was she who brought about the Minsk Accords, calling for the ceasefire and the negotiations in Ukraine. She has taken the lead in peacemaking. Now, when she was in Moscow yesterday, and she and Putin gave a public press conference afterward, she mentioned Crimea, and it surprised everybody. The issue was actually whether or not, is it in June, John, or July?
June.
That Europe has to decide
yes,
whether it's going to maintain, reduce, or remove the economic sanctions on Russia. Obviously, Russia wants them removed. So the question is, what does Russia have to do to get the sanctions removed? And here, nobody can remember, I can't remember, you can't remember, maybe your listeners remember, exactly why it was that the maximum sanctions were imposed. My recollection is they occurred right after the shootdown of the Malaysian aircraft over eastern Ukraine. Though today, we still don't know who shot that plane down. But the memory is that it has to do with Russian aggression in general in Ukraine. And that breaks down to two elements. Is it because Russia, way long ago, annexed, or as Russia says, reunified with the Crimean Peninsula, brought it into the Russian Federation from Ukraine? Or is it because Russia is being charged, you quoted the charges at the top, by NATO spokespeople, with supplying the fighters in eastern Ukraine? These are two different things. Generally speaking, everybody, even the regime in Kiev, but won't say it, understands that without war, Crimea will not be returned to Ukraine. End of story. So if you're going to say this will all end only when Crimea is returned, it will never end. Never. And therefore, it's largely been dropped. And that Kerry didn't mention it suggests that Washington knows it, that the issue now is the fighting in eastern Ukraine. Why did Merkel yesterday in Moscow mention it? I think because she's under tremendous pressure in Germany and in Europe to be less, how shall we say, accommodationist toward Putin. One reason she is the German economy is suffering heavily from these sanctions. Putin talked about it in Moscow with Merkel at the press conference. He rattled off the statistics. It's hurting Germany very badly. On the other hand, another half of Germany and Europe wants harsher measures against Russia. So I think she mentioned Ukraine to pretend as though she's taking the hard line, while in fact something as serious is going on, led by her, and now supported, I think, by Kerry and Obama, to make sure that Minsk does not fail.
Yes, but look at the Secretary Kerry. I want to read the quote here. If and when Minsk is fully implemented, it is clear the U.S. and EU sanctions can begin to be rolled back. He then adds, he added that Minsk agreements, if implemented without, quote, any breaches of the ceasefire whatsoever. We have Stoltenberg saying that the breaches are going on all the time, that there's lots of artillery fire, making accusations. Steve, the right hand and the left hand, do they belong to the same human being here?
But look, John, you and I are of an age where we understand that politics is plural and that we can speak, for example, of the Obama administration, I don't refer to Ukraine, but in general, and know that within the administration, there are conflicting factions on different policy issues. And we know that's true in the Kremlin, and we know that's true in Berlin. It's part of politics. And everywhere, always, it's an eternal truth about politics that there's division even within an outwardly singular united government. And now we see it revolving around what is the worst international crisis of our time. The confrontation, East and West, over Ukraine, the onset of a new Cold War that includes the risk of actual war with Russia. And it is only natural to the nature of politics that ruling groups in each country will divide. And they have in every capital. And if you want to talk about it, I could tell you a little more about the division in Putin's own ruling group in Moscow. But we should not be surprised. I don't know why anybody would be surprised that today in Sochi, Kerry spoke with the voice of the accommodationist wing, whereas at almost the same moment, representatives of NATO are speaking in a warfare.
One more detail about Secretary Kerry today. He said, when asked by a reporter, I'm following the report in Politico from Europe, from Brussels. When asked by a reporter about a recent proclamation from Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko that his government would reclaim the strategically important Donetsk airport. We're not even talking Crimea here. We're just talking about the front line of the Donetsk airport where they fought for weeks. Heavy artillery. They've destroyed it. They've turned it into a science fiction landscape.
It's rubble. Yeah.
His government would reclaim the strategically important Donetsk airport. This is the kind of promise that you make to the Azov battalion. Kerry said he hadn't seen the report, the usual dodge, but then he added he would strongly urge Poroshenko to think twice. He's warning the president of Ukraine to back off. That's the Secretary of State doing that.
And this all fits my interpretation that for whatever reason, maybe realization that this crisis is spinning out of control, that the Obama administration, assuming that Kerry speaks for the president of the United States, has decided to back Merkel.
Right.
Because look at the way you just quoted, Kerry formulated this.
Right.
If the ceasefire holds, the sanctions will be removed.
Right.
And there's nothing about Crimea.
And he's telling Poroshenko to think twice about breaking the ceasefire.
Let's think about what the leaders of Ukraine, of Kiev, that's Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk, the prime minister,
right,
have been saying. Just focus on Poroshenko, who is a reasonably moderate man in the context of what's become a very extreme Kiev regime.
All right, we have about a minute, Steve. Go ahead.
I can do it in 20 seconds.
Right.
Periodically, he has said, we are going to take back Crimea.
Yes.
By force. And moreover, there's going to be a war with Russia, and we're ready for it. This is exactly what Merkel does not want to hear. And today, Kerry said, in effect, to Poroshenko, Molchi, shut up.
Kerry thanked Russian President Vladimir Putin for the meeting, and he said, I am grateful to Mr. Putin for his directness and his very detailed explanation of Russia's position. And when we come back, we'll turn to May 9th and the celebration, the memorial to the victory over the Hitlerites in 1945 with Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian History. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here, and we're discussing surprising developments within these last hours in Ukraine crisis. John Kerry making statements of accommodation to Vladimir Putin and Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, in Sochi, the place where the Olympics started. You might recall the Olympics, the great celebration, Russia's back, billions of dollars spent to welcome the world, and then all of a sudden, Mr. Obama doesn't show up. And then we begin the Maidan protests, the confrontation, the snipers, the burning in Odessa, the MH17. The whole opera spills out after Mr. Obama did not appear at Sochi and other world leaders. And now, at Sochi, Mr. Kerry meets with Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Putin and makes statements that are suggestive that it's not just they want to deal with Moscow. It's also that they don't want to deal with Kiev, or they don't want Kiev starting a war again. They want to roll back the sanctions. Europe wants it rolled back, and we'll come back to that. Germany is critical here. However, I want to go to May 9th because Steve enjoyed, and I did too. I watched it entirely on YouTube, Steve, when they gave us packages afterwards. They were 9 hours before us. I was most impressed by the parade when they brought out the veterans. And you pointed out last week there are lots of veterans. They must have millions of veterans, Steve. People live a long time in Russia for the amount of vodka they claim they consume.
I'm a vodka drinker, but I'm not sure I'm going to get... They say that there are only 200,000 veterans. That is to say, people who actually fought in the war, not people who are alive, but people who fought during the war. There are only 200,000 left. But it did seem like all 200,000 of them were there on Red Square.
Right, with their chests filled with medals and bent over and smiling.
I don't know. It's 7 hours later in Moscow. It started at 10 o'clock. So I start watching at 2 a.m. I get on cable TV, live Russian TV, and I just sat there, and I intended to watch for an hour, and I couldn't let go. You can describe it in various ways. It was a fantastic spectacle of the kind that only Russians can put on. I mean, who else owns Red Square with all that history and those cathedrals and the Kremlin? The Tsars did it. The Soviets did it. The post-Soviets do it. It was a fantastic spectacle. Young and old, cameras even buried under the cobblestone of Red Square. So at one point you could see the boots of the soldiers marching, coming down. All sorts of new military equipment. None of that was surprising. What was different? Well, there were quite a few things, and they reflect our times. For one thing, regiments from all the Soviet republics, except perhaps Ukraine, that had been part of the Soviet Union and fought in the war, marched. Obviously, it wasn't them, but it was people wearing the uniforms of that time. So in a sense, on May 9th, 2015, the Soviet Union reappeared because all the replicas were Soviet banners and Soviet equipment before they got to the modern part of the parade. The uniforms were Soviet era. And Putin, who doesn't like to use the word Soviet Union, he prefers Russia, freely used the word, the Soviet Army, the Red Army, the Soviet Union. That's real history. You can't deny it. The second thing was politically. The Allies were not there, the Western Allies. But lots of other countries were there, leaders. And the most important was, of course, the leader of China.
Right.
Who was positioned to Putin's right next to him, and they never separated. Not at the social events, not at the walking events, not at the reviewing events. This was a message that China and Russia now have a virtual alliance. And not far away was the leader of India, and this makes up something over a third of the population of the world. So we can stop talking about Russia being isolated. That was very, very significant, and it was meant to send a political message. On the other hand, I thought Putin was very gracious in his short speech at the parade. Let me just quote him so that I don't summarize it. He said, "The Soviet Union bore the brunt of the enemy's attack. The Soviet Union liberated Europe from the Nazis." Those are factually true statements. We discussed them on the broadcast last week. But then he went on to say, despite the fact that that France and the United States and the UK had boycotted the event, he went on to say, "We are also very grateful to the peoples of Great Britain, France, and the United States for their enormous contribution to the victory," period. So he acknowledged our role more than Cameron or Obama has managed to do about Russia in their statements. But to me, the most unusual, I don't recall this, and I've been at May Day, I've been in Russia on May 9th on many occasions. My now 23-year-old daughter took her first step on May 9th, 1992, when we went to one of the parks to see the veterans gather and sing their songs after the parade. And when the veterans stood up playing their accordions and began to move away, our little Nika, who was then about 10 months old, as I recall, or almost a year old, suddenly for the first time stood off and kind of toddled off after the veterans. So she took her first step on May 9th. But the most unusual thing, and I don't think they've done this since 1945, but I'm not sure, is that after the parade, the thoroughfares that lead from the center of Moscow down to Red Square, the square was cleared of the parade. Citizens gathered at the top of this thoroughfare with their families, not just veterans, but lots of my friends who are not veterans, carrying placards of their loved ones who had fought in the war, many of whom died. There were 500,000 of them, a half a million people. The square, Red Square, was opened. They walked down. The cameras caught it. My friend in Russia, who's about my age, is certain that they never had so many people since the year the war ended in 1945. But the stunning part was, as the camera panned down to the middle of this group of ordinary Russian citizens, just walking along, there stood the leader of Russia, Putin, carrying a placard with a big picture of his father, who had fought in the war, who had been horribly wounded but survived. At that moment, Putin entered Russian history. Now, it was staged. There's no question about it. I mean, and you could look carefully. If you look for the earpiece, you know, that the security people wear, you could see that two or three people away from him or behind him, in front of him, big guys. Putin's not very tall. You could see his bodyguards. But there he was, a pretty risky thing for any leader to do, to walk in a crowd of 500,000 people. And there he was, and it was a moment that I don't think any Russian is going to soon forget. They say, this is Russian agencies, I don't know, that across the country, in a country of 145 million, 20 million people took part in one of the ceremonies or another on May 9th. So this was a special moment in Russian history, a special moment in Putin's leadership. And by the way, about a week before the parade, Putin, for the first time, published a little memoir article about what had happened to his own family in Leningrad, the city that had been blockaded for 4 years and where a million people died, that his older brother, 3 years older, died. His mother was barely snatched from the morgue, and his father was terribly wounded and never really recovered from his wartime wounds. So Putin is bound to this war, as are millions and millions of Russians. And when he went into the streets yesterday, I don't think any Russian leader in history, any Soviet leader, ever got anywhere near a crowd like that, with the possible exception of a moment after Gorbachev became leader and he did a couple of walking tours. But this was really something special. And it's that three-minute segment. It was called The Regiment of the Immortals, the people who fought in the war, is on YouTube. People can find it. It's probably labeled "People Putin in the Street" or something like that. Worth a look.
The photograph and the video, Steve, that I thought was most telling of the future, you've already mentioned. Mr. Putin sitting next to Mr. Xi, the president of China, and to his right was his wife, the first lady of China. Putin has no first lady at this moment, so they were flanked by two extremely senior military figures with chests full of medals and the translators behind them. There was no other world leader around, Steve. These are two men together, flanked by dignitaries and bodyguards and translators in all fashion. It was impossible to ignore. That this is this. I mean, you mentioned India. That's good. He was there, and other world leaders were there. But these two are together, Steve. And I note that Mr. Putin is now making statements about how Russia needs to secure production for its revived military from places that are not dependent upon Europe or Ukraine. He's looking to take business to Asia to build up the military. He said it's back, but now we have to increase it again. We have to grow it. He's looking right now, at least he's indicating, that he's going to move to China not just to sell them energy, but to develop a military presence that has not existed since the 20th century.
And they're going to do war exercises together and the rest. John, you mentioned something maybe 3 weeks ago. You quoted an article where the author said that the world security, the world order, is now being transformed.
Right.
And we talked about it a little bit. We saw that on May 9th. The absence of Western leaders, the presence of so many leaders from the East, and in particular not just the East, but so many leaders whose countries are not members of NATO. Raul Castro was there, for example. The leaders of the BRICS nations were there. We could see in this ceremony, however staged it was, a realignment going on. At the pivot, of course, is an emerging full-scale alliance between Russia and China. But you mentioned earlier in our broadcast tonight, Turkey.
Kerry went on to Turkey to meet with NATO, and Turkey is in between the two worlds.
But stop and think what's going on with Turkey now. If Putin has already signed a contract with Turkey, whereby Turkey will become the hub for Russian natural gas to Europe within 4 years, completely bypassing Ukraine.
Right.
But it would be great from the Russian point of view if Greece became part of that hub. Now, we all know Greece's financial situation. But Putin has said to Greece, if the EU doesn't want you, we would be happy to give you financial loans, give you, in return for accepting this hub, the transit fees, and end our sanctions on Greek agriculture. So even as we focus on China and Russia, we see everything is changing. And as a historian, I think it's fair to say something like this. It's a little simplistic, but generally it's the correct headline. After 1945, under Stalin, the Soviet Union left the West. There was no real Iron Curtain. But metaphorically speaking, Russia, the Soviet Union, put up an Iron Curtain between itself and the West. By the way, it wasn't the Iron Curtain to keep Russians in. It was to keep the West out. That's what the real metaphorical meaning of the Iron Curtain was. Today, in the last 14 months, we see Russia again, despite globalization, despite all the integration, despite the end of communism, despite the end of the Soviet Union, we see Russia leaving the West. But this time, it's not leaving voluntarily. It's been kicked out, as Russia sees it. This is something very different. But it's happening again.
Professor Stephen F. Cohn, New York University, Princeton University, Russian history. Too much good news. When we come back, the Republicans, their opinion of Ukraine crisis, and we're going into a presidential election. Mr. Obama and Mr. Kerry are profound right now. A year from now, I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohn, New York University, Princeton University, Russian history. We've been discussing surprising developments, John Kerry in Sochi meeting with Vladimir Putin and Sergei Lavrov. We've reflected on the significance of the May 9th celebration, commemoration of the victory over the Hitlerites by the Soviet Union, and also the significance of Mr. Putin sitting next to Mr. Xi of China. Now I mention that this is a presidential year, and we're moving into a presidential election in 2016. And Steve, I have to bring up the fact that the Republicans are in play here. Mr. Rubio, Marco Rubio, who is regarded as an eloquent and extremely powerful presence in the Republican candidacy right now, mentions that he wants NATO to remain open to bringing in Ukraine. We can believe now, given the Ukraine crisis, that the Republicans are going to weigh in on decisions made over this next year about Ukraine. We can also believe that Kiev is listening very closely. Marco Rubio commands an audience in the Republican Party. We do not know at this time Mrs. Clinton's opinion about so many things, but certainly about Ukraine. So though Mr. Kerry and Mr. Obama perhaps can come to an accommodation with Mr. Putin and Mr. Lavrov, that doesn't mean the Republicans will move in that direction. I'm assuming Russia is very well informed of our presidential elections, that everything gets a little crazy for a while. But Steve, Kiev can hold on to the Republicans, can go as right as it wants, and it'll have a home in Washington.
As of today, May 12th, there is no Democrat proposed to challenge this who's expressed interest in the presidency. So I'm not blaming the Republicans. This is a profound failure of our political class across the spectrum. What Rubio said doesn't surprise me. He's made it clear that he thinks that the Republican base that he needs in the primaries wants this kind of red meat. we will stand with Ukraine forever to the point of war with Russia.
NATO, emphasis of NATO,
well,
yes.
But if he can connect dots,
right.
I'm not sure he can. I mean, I don't know how smart he is.
I'm told that he's extremely well-informed, especially about Europe. And this was a speech that he's entitled, My Vision for Europe.
But
it's exactly what Kiev wants to hear.
But what we've seen since the crisis began is a political leadership in this country that cannot connect dots. They can't think of the consequences of the policy that they advocate. If Rubio runs on the position that the door to membership in NATO is permanently open to Ukraine.
That's exactly what he said. Yes.
Which, by the way, was the position of the Obama administration, has been for years. They've never altered that. And that were to be acted on, it would certainly lead to war with Russia. So if he can connect a dot, somebody will tell him that you are advocating war with Russia. Is that what you want to go to the American people on? And when I visit my people, many of whom in Kentucky and Indiana, who vote for Republicans, I don't hear they want that. So the puzzle to me is why there's not, and leave aside the Democrats, why there's not, since we know who the Republican candidates more or less are going to be, there's not one who's going to challenge Rubio on this policy.
No,
now, the logical person is Rand Paul.
No, there's no challenge in the Republican side, and I follow them closely.
Let me argue with you a minute. Everything that Senator Paul from my home state of Kentucky has said about why we should not get more deeply involved directly in the Middle East applies absolutely 100% to Ukraine.
He has very carefully backed off from his non-intervention remarks of early in the campaign, Steve. He's now moved into a fog of rhetoric about intervention.
When the Ukrainian crisis began, Senator Paul said, I believe I quote him correctly, the Ukrainian crisis is a result of the United States having built a bridge too far. I think that was his expression, meaning we got involved in a faraway place, in somebody else's backyard, in an area that represents no national security to us whatsoever. And this, said Paul, is what I mean about overextending. That is absolute pure wisdom. Has he really abandoned it altogether? I don't know.
I can't give you anything definitive. I just flag this for now, Steve, because there's some sunshine here. I just flag the fact that we're going into a campaign when there will be other voices determining the Ukraine policy besides Mr. Obama and Mr. Kerry. Steve Cohen, professor of Russian history, NYU and Princeton University emeritus, discussing this moment of sunshine with John Kerry in Sochi with Vladimir Putin. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.